the biggest players of all. We are built to play and built through play. When we play, we are engaged in the purest expression of our humanity, the truest expression of our individuality. Is it any wonder that often the times we feel most alive, those that make up our best memories, are moments of play? Play expands our minds in ways that allow us to explore, to germinate new ideas or see old ideas in a new light. It makes us more inquisitive, more attuned to novelty, more engaged. Play is fundamental to living the way of the essentialist because it fuels exploration in at least three specific ways. First, play broadens the range of options available to us. It helps us to see possibilities we otherwise wouldn't have seen and make connections we would otherwise not have made. It opens our minds and broadens our perspective. It helps us challenge old assumptions and makes us more receptive to untested ideas. It gives us permission to expand our own stream of consciousness and come up with new stories. Or as Albert Einstein once said, "When I examine myself and my methods of thought, I come to the conclusion that the gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing positive knowledge." Second, play is an antidote to stress. And this is key because stress, in addition to being an enemy of productivity, can actually shut down the creative, inquisitive, exploratory parts of our brain. You know how it feels. You're stressed about work and suddenly everything starts going wrong. You can't find your keys, you bump into things more easily, you forget the critical report on the kitchen table. Recent findings suggest this is because stress increases the activity in the part of the brain that monitors emotions, the amygdala, while reducing the activity in the part responsible for cognitive function, the hippocampus. The result being, simply, that we really can't think clearly. I have seen play reverse these effects in my own children. When they are stressed and things feel out of control, I have them draw. When they do, the change is almost immediate. The stress melts away and their ability to explore is regained. Third, as Edward M. Hallowell, a psychiatrist who specializes in brain science, explains, play has a positive effect on the executive function of the brain. The brain's executive functions, he writes, include planning, prioritizing, scheduling, anticipating, delegating, deciding, analyzing, in short, most of the skills any executive must master in order to excel in business. Play stimulates the parts of the brain involved in both careful, logical reasoning and carefree, unbound exploration. Given that, it should hardly be surprising that key breakthroughs in thinking have taken place in times of play. Hallowell writes, "Columbus was at play when it dawned on him that the world was round. Newton was at play in his mind when he saw the apple tree and suddenly conceived of the force of gravity. Watson and Crick were playing with possible shapes of the DNA molecule when they stumbled upon the double helix. Shakespeare played with iambic pentameter his whole life. Mozart barely lived a waking moment when he was not at play. Einstein's thought experiments are brilliant examples of the mind invited to play." Of work and play. Some innovative companies are finally waking up to the essential value of play. The CEO of Twitter, Dick Costolo, promotes play through comedy. He instigated an improv class at the company. As a former stand-up comedian, he knows that improv forces people to stretch their minds and think more flexibly, unconventionally, and creatively. Other companies promote playfulness through their physical environments. IDEO conducts meetings inside a microbus. In the halls of Google, you're likely to stumble upon, in one example of many, a large dinosaur covered in pink flamingos. At Pixar Studios, artists' offices may be decorated like anything from an old-time Western saloon to a wooden hut. The one that most amazed me when I visited was the one lined floor to ceiling with thousands of Star Wars figurines. A successful woman I knew at a publishing company kept an easy button from Staples on her desk. Anytime anyone left her office, they would enjoy the childish thrill of slamming their palm down on the big red button, causing a recorded voice to loudly announce to the entire office, "That was easy." And another woman down the hall at the same company had a framed poster in her office of a children's book illustration to remind her of the joy of childhood reading. Desk toys, dinosaurs covered with flamingos, and offices full of action figures may seem like trivial diversions to some, but the very point is that they can be the exact opposite. These efforts challenge the non-essentialist logic that play is trivial. Instead, they celebrate play as a vital driver of creativity and exploration. Play doesn't just help us to explore what is essential, it is essential, in and of itself. So how can we all introduce more play into our workplaces and our lives? In his book, Brown includes a primer to help readers reconnect with play. He suggests that readers mine their past for play memories. What did you do as a child that excited you? How can you recreate that today? Chapter 8. Sleep. Protect the asset. Each night when I go to sleep, I die. And the next morning when I wake up, I am reborn. Mahatma Gandhi. Jeff sat straight up in bed in a panic. He felt as if a bomb had exploded in his head. He was sweating and discombobulated. He listened intensely. What was going on? Everything was silent. Perhaps it was a weird reaction to something he'd eaten. He tried to go back to sleep. The next night it happened again. Then a few days later it happened in the middle of the day. He had just returned from India, and at first he thought it might be a reaction to malaria medicine he was taking in combination with the Benadryl he took to help him sleep when he was jet-lagged. But as his situation worsened, he found his condition was more complicated. It was like he was experiencing anxiety attacks, but without any anxiety, just the physical symptoms. Jeff was a textbook overachiever who had a deep desire to make a difference. To give some context for this, his grandfather was an early administrator in the Peace Corps. Jeff was fiercely ambitious, driven, and committed to making a contribution to the world. He was on the board of Kiva. He had been named Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year and a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum. He was the co-founder of a successful impact investment fund, and he was the CEO of a global microcredit organization that was reaching more than 12 million poor families around the world. He was 36 years old and on top of his game. Jeff traveled constantly, which often made sleep difficult. His company was based in Seattle, but had offices in San Francisco, India, and Kenya. He would routinely fly to London for meetings, then to India for 6 days, to be in 5 different cities, to Geneva for hours of meetings with investors, and then back to Seattle for a day and a half. For 3 years, he traveled 60 to 70% of the time. On average, he slept about 4 to 6 hours a night. But at the ripe age of 36, his pace of work was starting to threaten his health and his ability to contribute. What started with the nighttime attacks worsened. One by one, each of his organs started shutting down. His heart rate was erratic. It became painful to stand up straight. He had to blend his food because he could not digest it. His blood pressure was so low he blacked out if he stood up too fast. He went to the emergency room twice. He kept telling himself he would slow down after the next deal, then the next, then the one after that. But of course he didn't. He was sure that if he just kept going, he could work his way out of this. He didn't want to face the trade-offs that scaling back entailed. But they soon caught up with him. He would be forced to cancel meetings at the last minute because he was too weak to attend, or he would give a speech but bomb it because his brain was cloudy. He started to wonder if he was doing the company more harm than good, and he definitely was. Eventually, after a clear diagnosis, he was given 2 options by his doctor. He could take medications for the rest of his life to deal with his symptoms, or he could disengage from everything for 1 or 2 to treat and recover from his illness. Jeff didn't accept this trade-off at first. He was a competitive triathlete, and he thought he could apply the same logic he would to an ankle sprain or a torn rotator cuff. He boastfully told the doctor he would take a couple of months off and be back to full form. Watch. Just watch. He took a 2-month sabbatical, and to his surprise, he totally crashed. He slept 14 hours per night. Then he rested all day long. He could not even get out of bed some days. He was totally non-functional for 6 weeks. He came crawling back to his doctor and admitted this was going to take a lot longer than a couple of months. True to his word, he got rid of everything that was creating stress in his life. He resigned from his boards and decided to leave his company too. He said, "The decision to disengage was very, very difficult. I walked out of the board meeting, tears in my eyes, and said to my wife, 'This is not how I wanted to leave my baby.'" He designed a life totally devoted to regeneration and recuperation as he went through the treatment protocol. He changed his diet. He went to the south of France for a year with his family. The treatment and change in climate and lifestyle worked. With a new mindset, he began to think about what he had learned through the experience. 2.5 years later, Jeff was in Tanzania for a Young Global Leaders event with the World Economic Forum. One evening at an open mic night, Jeff was urged by those who knew his story to share what he had learned with the group of 200 accomplished peers. Through great emotion, he told them that he had paid a high price to learn a simple yet essential lesson. Protect the asset. Protecting the asset. The best asset we have for making a contribution to the world is ourselves. If we underinvest in ourselves, and by that I mean our minds, our bodies, and our spirits, we damage the very tool we need to make our highest contribution. One of the most common ways people, especially ambitious, successful people, damage this asset is through a lack of sleep. If we let our type A instincts take over, we will, like Jeff, be swallowed up whole. We will burn out too early. We need to be as strategic with ourselves as we are with our careers and our businesses. We need to pace ourselves, nurture ourselves, and give ourselves fuel to explore, thrive, and perform. In the many hours Jeff spent resting, he came to see an interesting paradox in his addiction to achievement. For a type A personality, it is not hard to push oneself hard. Pushing oneself to the limit is easy. The real challenge for the person who thrives on challenges is not to work hard. He explains to any overachievers, "If you think you are so tough you can do anything, I have a challenge for you. If you really want to do something hard, say no to an opportunity so you can take a nap." By the time I was 21, I too thought of sleep as something to be avoided. To me it was a necessary evil, a waste of time that could otherwise be spent productively, something for the weak, or the weak-willed. The vision of being superhuman and sleeping only a few hours a night was intoxicating. I even experimented with some rather drastic and unconventional ways to try to cut down on sleep. After reading a sleep study where some participants were required to sleep only 20 minutes every 4 hours around the clock, I tried it out. It was bearable for a while, but I soon found that while you can technically survive on this schedule of sleep, it has its drawbacks. For example, while I was technically awake, my brain was just barely functioning. It was harder to think, plan, prioritize, or see the bigger picture. It was hard to make decisions or choices, and nearly impossible to discern the essential from the trivial. It soon became unsustainable, but still I was determined that the less I slept, the more I could get done. So I adopted the new tactic of pulling one all-nighter per week. This was not much better. Then my wife, who did not care for this practice, gave me an article that completely shifted the way I saw sleep. It challenged the notion that sleep was an enemy of productivity, convincingly arguing that in fact sleep was a driver of peak performance. I remember the article cited top business leaders who boasted about getting a full 8 hours. I also remember Bill Clinton was quoted as saying that every major mistake he had made in his life had happened as a result of sleep deprivation. Ever since, I have tried to get 8 hours a night. What about you? Think about the last week. Have you slept less than 7 hours on any of those nights? Have you slept less than 7 hours for a few nights in a row? Have you caught yourself saying or thinking proudly, "Not me. I don't need the full 8 hours. I can totally survive on 4 or 5 hours of sleep. If you thought that right now, listening to this, you will get a lot out of this chapter. Well, while there are clearly people who can survive on fewer hours of sleep, I've found that most of them are just so used to being tired, they have forgotten what it really feels like to be fully rested. The way of the non-essentialist is to see sleep as yet another burden on one's already overextended, overcommitted, busy but not always productive life. Essentialists, instead, see sleep as necessary for operating at high levels of contribution more of the time. This is why they systematically and deliberately build sleep into their schedules so they can do more, achieve more, and explore more. By protecting their asset, they are able to go about their daily lives with a reserve of energy, creativity, and problem-solving ability to call upon when needed, unlike non-essentialists who can never know when and where they'll be hijacked by their own fatigue. Essentialists choose to do one fewer thing right now in order to do more tomorrow. Yes, it is a trade-off, but cumulatively, this small trade-off can yield big rewards. A non-essentialist thinks 1 hour less of sleep equals 1 more hour of productivity. Sleep is for failures. Sleep is a luxury. Sleep breeds laziness. Sleep gets in the way of doing it all. An essentialist knows 1 hour more of sleep equals several more hours of much higher productivity. Sleep is for high performers. Sleep is a priority. Sleep breeds creativity. Sleep enables the highest levels of mental contribution. Shattering the sleep stigma. So if protecting the asset is so important, why do we give up our precious sleep so easily? For overachievers, part of the reason may be that they simply subscribe to the false belief, as I did, that if they sleep less, they will achieve more. Yet there are ample reasons to challenge this assumption, like the growing body of research demonstrating that a good night's sleep actually makes us more productive, not less. In K. Anders Ericsson's famous study of violinists, popularized by Malcolm Gladwell as the 10,000-hour rule, Anders found that the best violinists spent more time practicing than the merely good students. His finding supports essentialist logic by showing that mastery takes focused and deliberate effort. And indeed, it's encouraging to learn that excellence is within our sphere of influence rather than a blessing bestowed only on the most naturally gifted. But it also comes dangerously close to encouraging the non-essentialist mindset of, I have to do it all. The pernicious myth that can lead people to justify spending longer and longer hours working with diminishing returns. That is, until we look at a less well-known finding from the same study, that the second most important factor differentiating the best violinists from the good violinists was actually sleep. The best violinists slept an average of 8.6 hours in every 24-hour period, about an hour longer than the average American. Over the period of a week, they also spent an average of 2.8 hours of napping in the afternoon, about 2 hours longer than the average. Sleep, the authors of the study concluded, allowed these top performers to regenerate so that they could practice with greater concentration. So yes, while they practiced more, they also got more out of those hours of practice because they were better rested. In a Harvard Business Review article called Sleep Deficit, the Performance Killer, Charles A. Seisler, the Baldino Professor of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School, has explained how sleep deprivation undermines high performance. He likens sleep deficit to drinking too much alcohol, explaining that pulling an all-nighter, i.e. going 24 hours without sleep, or having a week of sleeping just 4 or 5 hours a night, actually induces an impairment equivalent to a blood alcohol level of 0.1%. Think about this. We would never say, this person is a great worker, he's drunk all the time. Yet we continue to celebrate people who sacrifice sleep for work. While sleep is often associated with giving rest to the body, Recent research shows that sleep is really more about the brain. Indeed, a study from the Lübeck University in Germany provides evidence that a full night's sleep may actually increase brain power and enhance our problem-solving ability. In the study reported by the journal Nature, over 100 volunteers were given a number puzzle with an unconventional twist. It required finding a hidden code to uncover the answer. The volunteers were divided into two groups. One was allowed an 8-hour stretch of uninterrupted sleep, and another group received interrupted sleep. The scientists then watched to see which volunteers found the hidden code and how quickly they found it. The result was that twice the number of people who had slept for 8 hours solved the problem than the volunteers from the sleep-deprived group. Why? The researchers explained that while we sleep, our brains are hard at work encoding and restructuring information. Therefore, when we wake up, our brains may have made new neural connections, thereby opening up a broader range of solutions to problems literally overnight. Some good news for the early birds and night owls among us. Science shows that even a nap can increase creativity. In just one example, a report from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences revealed that even a single REM, or rapid eye movement, cycle enhanced the integration of unassociated information. Even a brief period of deep sleep, in other words, helps us make the kinds of new connections that allow us to better explore our world. In a nutshell, sleep is what allows us to operate at our highest level of contribution so that we can achieve more in less time. While there continues to be a culture of machismo, when it comes to going without sleep, luckily the stigma is fading, thanks in part to a few super high performers, particularly in industries that typically celebrate burning the candle at both ends, who have publicly boasted about getting a full 8 hours. These people, many of them true essentialists, know their healthy sleep habits give them a huge competitive advantage, and they are right. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, is one of them. He says, "I'm more alert and I think more clearly. I just feel so much better all day long if I've had 8 hours." Marc Andreessen, co-founder of Netscape and a reformed sleep restrictor, who used to work till the early hours but still be up at 7 a.m., is another. He said, "I would spend the whole day wishing I could go home and go back to bed." Now, he says of his level of sleep, 7 hours and I start to degrade. 6 is suboptimal. 5 is a big problem. 4 means I'm a zombie. On weekends, he sleeps 12 plus hours. "It makes a big difference in my ability to function," he said. These executives are quoted in an article called "Sleep is the New Status Symbol for Successful Entrepreneurs." Nancy Jeffrey of the Wall Street Journal writes, "It's official. Sleep, that rare commodity in stressed-out America, is the new status symbol." Once derided as a wimpish failing, the same 1980s overachievers who cried lunch is for losers also believed sleep is for suckers. Slumber is now being touted as the restorative companion to the creative executive mind. To this we can add that it is also the restorative companion to the discerning essentialist mind. In another article in the New York Times, Aaron Callan, the former chief financial officer of Lehman Brothers, tells the story of how at an office party in 2005, one of my colleagues asked my then husband what I did on weekends. She knew me as someone with great intensity and energy. "Does she kayak, go rock climbing, and then run a half marathon?" she joked. "No," he answered simply. "She sleeps." And that was true. When I wasn't catching up on work, I spent my weekends recharging my batteries for the coming week. So, if the stigma of sleep still exists in your workplace, consider developing an initiative at work to explicitly encourage sleep. If that sounds radical, consider how the many benefits of sleep, greater creativity, enhanced productivity, even lower healthcare costs, have the potential to directly affect the bottom line. With this perspective, it is not so hard to imagine encouraging your manager or HR department to develop a written policy. After all, many companies have policies addressing alcohol consumption, and as we have seen, The parallels in how alcohol and sleep deprivation affect performance are real. For example, Charles Sisler at Harvard has proposed a policy that no employee is expected to drive into work after a red-eye flight. And other companies allow employees to come in late after staying late at work the previous night. Companies and leaders like these know that protecting their assets is a matter of fiduciary responsibility. Under the auspices of Book Research, I recently went to Google to take a nap in one of their famous nap pods. It was a white spaceship pod, like something you might imagine seeing on the 70s TV show Mork and Mindy, of about 20 square feet, big enough to lie down but not completely flat. It had a dome-shaped cover that concealed most but not all of my body, and as a result, I was a little self-conscious at first and wondered whether I would be able to fall asleep. 30 minutes later, as the pod vibrated gently to let me know my session was over, I didn't have to wonder. When I woke up from the nap, I could really feel how much I had needed it. I felt clearer, sharper, more alert. To use the pods at Google, there is a calendar sign-up. How many people used it the week I was there, I wondered. Of the 50 people who work on the floor where it is situated, I imagined at least 10 or 20. Wrong. According to the calendar, just a single person had taken this opportunity to recharge brain and body with 30 minutes of midday sleep. Nevertheless, even the presence of the pod is important in signaling to employees that sleep is a priority. Our highest priority is to protect our ability to prioritize. In this section of the book, we have been talking about how to explore and evaluate options in order to discern the essential few from the many trivial, mediocre, or even just good. By definition, this is a process of prioritization. It includes the challenge of filtering options that, at first glance, all look important. Yet, as the logic of an essentialist explains, in reality there are only a few things of exceptional value, with most everything else being of far less importance. The problem with being sleep-deprived is that it compromises our ability to tell the difference, and thus our precious ability to prioritize. Sleep will enhance your ability to explore, make connections, and do less but better throughout your waking hours. Chapter 9. Select. The power of extreme criteria. An inner process stands in need of outward criteria. Ludwig Wittgenstein. In a piece called No More Yes, It's Either Hell Yeah or No, the popular TED speaker Derek Sivers describes a simple technique for becoming more selective in the choices we make. The key is to put the decision to an extreme test. If we feel total and utter conviction to do something, then we say yes, Derek style. Anything less gets a thumbs down. Or as a leader at Twitter once put it to me, if the answer isn't a definite yes, then it should be a no. It is a succinct summary of a core essentialist principle and one that is critical to the process of exploration. Derek lives this principle himself. When he wasn't blown away by any of the candidates he interviewed for a job, he said no to all of them. Eventually, he found exactly the right person. When he realized he had signed up for several conferences around the world that he wasn't really stoked about, he decided to stay home and skip all of them, and in turn earned 12 days he used to more productive ends. When he was trying to decide where to live, he ruled out places that seemed pretty good, Sydney and Vancouver, until he visited New York and knew instantly it was exactly the right place for him. Think back to what happens to our closets when we use the broad criterion. Is there a chance that I will wear this someday in the future? The closet becomes cluttered with clothes we rarely wear. But if we ask, do I absolutely love this? Then we will be able to eliminate the clutter and have space for something better. We can do the same with other choices, whether big or small, significant or trivial, in every area of our lives. The 90% rule. Recently, a colleague and I were working to select 24 people from a pool of almost 100 applicants to our Design Life Essentially class. First, we identified a set of minimum criteria such as can attend every class. Then we settled on a set of ideal attributes like is ready for a life-changing experience. Using these criteria, we scored each candidate on a 1 to 10 scale. The 9s and 10s we decided were obviously in. Anyone under a 7 was automatically out. I was then given the unenviable task of evaluating the in-between candidates, the 7s and 8s. As I struggled to determine which of these candidates would be good enough, I had the thought, if something, or in this case someone, is just or almost good enough, that is, a 7 or an 8, then the answer should be a no. It was so liberating. You can think of this as the 90% rule, and it's one you can apply to just about every decision or dilemma. As you evaluate an option, think about the single most important criterion for that decision, and then simply give the option a score between 0 and 100. If you rate it any lower than 90%, then automatically change the rating to 0 and simply reject it. This way, you avoid getting caught up in indecision or worse, getting stuck with the 60s or 70s. Think about how you'd feel if you scored a 65 on some test. Why would you deliberately choose to feel that way about an important choice in your life? Mastering this essentialist skill, perhaps more than any other in this section, requires us to be vigilant about acknowledging the reality of trade-offs. By definition, applying highly selective criteria is a trade-off. Sometimes you will have to turn down a seemingly very good option and have faith that the perfect option will soon come along. Sometimes it will and sometimes it won't, but the point is that the very act of applying selective criteria forces you to choose which perfect option to wait for, rather than letting other people or the universe choose for you. Like any essentialist skill, it forces you to make decisions by design rather than default. The benefits of this ultra-selective approach to decision-making in all areas of our lives should be clear. When our selection criteria are too broad, we will find ourselves committing to too many options. What's more, assigning simple numerical values to our options forces us to make decisions consciously, logically, and rationally, rather than impulsively or emotionally. Yes, it takes discipline to apply tough criteria, but failing to do so carries a high cost. Non-essentialists apply implicit or unspoken criteria to the decisions they make in both their personal and their professional lives. For example, when deciding what projects to take on at work, a non-essentialist may operate by the implicit criterion, if my manager asks me to do it, then I should do it. Or even more broadly, if someone asks me to do it, I should try to do it. Or still more broadly, if other people in the company are doing it, I should be doing it. In an era of social media where we are vastly more aware of what other people are doing, this criterion can create a particularly serious burden by amplifying all of the non-essential activities we should be doing. A non-essentialist says yes to almost every request or opportunity. An essentialist says yes only to the top 10% of opportunities. A non-essentialist uses broad, implicit criteria like, if someone I know is doing it, I should do it. An essentialist uses narrow, explicit criteria like, is this exactly what I am looking for? One executive team I worked with had at one time identified 3 criteria for deciding what projects to take on. But over time, they had become more and more indiscriminate, and eventually the company's portfolio of projects seemed to share only the criterion that a customer had asked them to do it. As a result, the morale on the team had plummeted, and not simply because team members were overworked and overwhelmed from having taken on too much. It was also because no project ever seemed to justify itself, and there was no greater sense of purpose. Worse, it now became difficult to distinguish themselves in the marketplace because their work, which had previously occupied a unique and profitable niche, had become so general. Only by going through the work of identifying extreme criteria were they able to get rid of the 70 and 80% that were draining their time and resources and start focusing on the most interesting work that best distinguished them in the marketplace. Furthermore, this system empowered employees to choose the projects on which they could make their highest contribution. Where they had once been at the mercy of what felt like capricious management decisions, they now had a voice. On one occasion I saw the quietest and most junior member of the team push back on the most senior executive. She simply said, "Should we be taking on this account, given the criteria we have?" This had never happened until the criteria were made both selective and explicit. Making our criteria both selective and explicit affords us a systematic tool for discerning what is essential and filtering out the things that are not. Selective, explicit, and also right. Mark Adams, the managing director of Vitsu, has spent the last 27 years deliberately applying selective criteria to his work. Vitsu makes furniture. The furniture industry is notorious for churning out a high volume of product. Each season brings a vast offering of new colors and styles. Yet Vitsu has for decades offered only one product, the 606 Universal Shelving System. Why? Because quite simply, Vitsu has very particular standards, and the 606 Universal Shelving System is the only product that makes the cut. The 606 system epitomizes the essentialist ethic of less but better, discussed in Chapter 1 and advocated by Dieter Rams. This is more than coincidence, given that the 606 Universal Shelving System was designed by Dieter. But Vitsu's approach to hiring may be more selective still. They begin with the basic assumption that they would rather be understaffed than hire the wrong person quickly. Accordingly, when they are looking for a new employee, they have a rigorous and systematic selection process. First, they interview someone by phone. This is deliberate because they want to strip away all visual cues while forming their first impression. Equally, they want to hear how the prospective employee performs on the phone and whether the employee is organized enough to find a quiet place at an allotted time. They weed out many at this stage in a time-efficient manner. Second, a candidate is interviewed by multiple people throughout the company. If a candidate makes it through several interviews, he or she is invited to spend a day working with the team. Then management sends a questionnaire out to the whole team asking them how they feel about the candidate. But instead of just the obvious questions, they ask, would he or she love working here? And would we love having him or her work with us? No offer is made at this point and no commitment is implied on the part of the candidate. The objective is to allow both sides to see each other as honestly as possible. If the fit is just right, the candidate will continue through the final interviews and may receive an offer. If the team isn't absolutely sure, then the answer is no. Once they had a candidate applying for a job on the shelving installation team, it is an important role. These installers are the face of the product and the company. The candidate in question did a good job installing the shelving system. But in the debrief with Mark afterwards, the team had a concern. At the end of the day, when they were packing up their tools, the candidate just threw the tools into the box and closed the lid. To you and me, this would seem a minor infraction, hardly significant enough to mention, let alone overshadow a day's worth of otherwise flawless work. But to the team, it signified a carelessness that didn't jibe with their vision of the ideal person for the job. Mark listened and agreed, then politely told the candidate he wasn't the right fit with the Vitsu culture. For Mark and his team, if it isn't a clear yes, then it's a clear no. But undergirding their highly selective screening process is more than a gut reaction, although that matters too. What may seem like a capricious decision is really the result of a disciplined and continuous approach to figure out what works and what doesn't. For example, they have learned that there is a high correlation between how intensely someone played with Legos as a child and how well he or she will fit with the Vitsu culture. They didn't pick that out of the air. They have tried all manner of things over the years. Some have stuck, but many have not. The team also uses an explicit set of criteria in making their evaluation. Their primary criterion is, will this person be an absolutely natural fit? That is why they have designed the selection process to include multiple interviews. That is why they developed the workday trial run. It's why they send the questionnaire. Like any true essentialist, they are trying to gather the relevant information so they can make an informed, calculated, deliberate decision. Box CEO Aaron Levy has a similar criterion for hiring. He simply asks if the person is someone he'd want to work with every day. One of the ways we think about this is, he says, could this person have been one of the founding members of the team? If the answer is yes, he knows he's found someone who will fit right in. Opportunity knocks. Being selective when deciding what opportunities to go after is one thing, but it can get even harder when opportunities come to us. We get a job offer we didn't expect. A side project comes along that isn't really what we do, but it is easy cash. Someone asks us to help out with something we love doing, but it's unpaid work. An acquaintance has a timeshare available in a less than ideal location, but at a discounted rate. What do we do? The fear of missing out goes into full effect. How can we say no? The offer is right here for the taking. We might never have gone after it, but now it is so easy to get it, we consider it. But if we just say yes, because it is an easy reward, we run the risk of having to later say no to a more meaningful one. This was the situation Nancy Duarte found herself in when building a communication agency. In 2000, the company was a generalist agency doing everything from creating corporate identities to print and website development to designing presentations, work most designer firms loathe doing. But without one specialty to differentiate them, the company started to become pretty much like any other design agency out there. Then Nancy read Jim Collins' Good to Great, in which he contends if there's one thing you are passionate about, and that you can be best at, you should be doing just that one thing. That's when she realized the real opportunity to differentiate the company might be in the very type of work nobody else in the industry wanted to do. Designing presentations. By focusing on work no one else was doing, they could create the knowledge, tools, and expertise to become the premier company in the world at presentations. But to achieve this, they would have to say no to everything else, even in bad economic times, even when paid work was offered to them. It was the price for becoming distinct. In other words, they would have to be more selective in the work they took on, so they could channel all their energies toward excelling in the area that had become their specialty. Here's a simple, systematic process you can use to apply selective criteria to opportunities that come your way. First, write down the opportunity. Second, write down a list of three minimum criteria the options would need to pass in order to be considered. Third, write down a list of three ideal or extreme criteria the options would need to pass in order to be considered. By definition, if the opportunity doesn't pass the first set of criteria, the answer is obviously no. But if it also doesn't pass two of your three extreme criteria, the answer is still no. Applying tougher criteria to life's big decisions allows us to better tap into our brain's sophisticated search engine. Think of it as the difference between conducting a Google search for good restaurant in New York City and best slice of pizza in downtown Brooklyn. If we search for a good career opportunity, our brain will serve up scores of pages to explore and work through. Instead, why not conduct an advanced search and ask three questions? What am I deeply passionate about? And what taps my talent? And what meets a significant need in the world? Naturally, there won't be as many pages to view, but that is the point of the exercise. We aren't looking for a plethora of good things to do. We are looking for the one where we can make our absolutely highest point of contribution. Enrique Sala is someone who found his life's calling in this way. Early on in his career, Enrique was a professor at the prestigious Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. But he couldn't kick the feeling that the career path he was on was just a close second to the path he should really be on. So he left academia and went to work with National Geographic. With that success came new and intriguing opportunities in Washington, D.C. that again left him feeling he was close to the right career path, but not quite on it yet. As often happens to driven, ambitious people, his earlier success had distracted him from his clarity of purpose. Since the moment he had watched Jacques Cousteau aboard the famed Calypso, he had dreamed of diving in the world's most beautiful oceans. So after a couple of years, when a golden opportunity presented itself, he changed gears again in order to be where he could truly make his highest contribution, as an explorer in residence with National Geographic, where he could spend a significant portion of his time diving in the most remote locations while also using his strengths in science and communications to influence policy on a global scale. The price of his dream job was saying no to the many good, even very good, parallel opportunities he encountered, and waiting for the one he could enthusiastically say yes to. And the wait was worth it. Enrique is one of those relatively rare examples of someone who is doing work that he loves, that taps his talent, and that serves an important need in the world. His main objective is to help create the equivalent of national parks to protect the last pristine places in the ocean. A truly essential contribution. Eliminate. How can we cut out the trivial many? Think back to the closet metaphor we talked about in Chapter 1. At this point in the book, you've taken stock of everything hanging in your closet. You have your clothes divided into piles of must-keep and probably should get rid of. But are you really ready to stuff the probably should get rid of pile in a bag and send it off? In other words, it's not enough to simply determine which activities and efforts don't make the best possible contribution. You still have to actively eliminate those that do not. Part 3 of this book will show you how to eliminate the non-essentials, so you can make a higher level of contribution toward the things that are actually vital. And not only that, but you'll learn to do it in a way that actually garners you more respect from your colleagues, bosses, clients, and peers. Getting rid of those old clothes isn't easy. After all, there is still that nagging reluctance, that nagging fear that, what if, years down the road, you come to regret giving away that blazer with the big shoulder pads and loud pinstripes. This feeling is normal. Studies have found that we tend to value things we already own more highly than they are worth, and thus find them more difficult to get rid of. If you're not quite ready to part with that metaphorical blazer, ask the killer question. If I didn't already own this, how much would I spend to buy it? Likewise, in your life, the killer question when deciding what activities to eliminate is, if I didn't have this opportunity, what would I be willing to do to acquire it? Of course, finding the discipline to say no to opportunities, often very good opportunities, that come your way in work and life is infinitely harder than throwing out old clothes in your closet. But find it you must, because remember that any time you fail to say no to a non-essential, you are really saying yes by default. So once you have sufficiently explored your options, the question you should be asking yourself is not, what of my list of competing priorities should I say yes to? Instead, ask the essential question, what will I say no to? This is the question that will uncover your true priorities. It is the question that will reveal the best path forward for your team. It is the question that will uncover your true purpose and help you make the highest level of contribution, not only to your own goals, but to the mission of your organization. It is that question that can deliver the rare and precious clarity necessary to achieve game-changing breakthroughs in your career and in your life. Chapter 10. Clarify. One decision that makes a thousand. The crime which bankrupts men and states is job work. Declining from your main design to serve a turn here or there. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Let's start with a game. Following are three mission statements from three Fortune 500 companies. Try to match each company with its mission statement. Company 1, AGCO. a chief manufacturer and distributor of agricultural equipment such as replacement parts, tractors, hay tools, and implements. Company 2. Dover Corporation. A manufacturer of equipment such as garbage trucks and electronic equipment such as inkjet printers and circuit board assemblies. Company 3. Dean Foods Corporation. A food and beverage company, in particular a milk, dairy, and soy products manufacturer. Now the mission statements. A. Profitable growth through superior customer service, innovation, quality, and commitment. B. To be the leader in every market we serve to the benefit of our customers and our shareholders. C. The company's primary objective is to maximize long-term stockholder value while adhering to the laws of the jurisdictions in which it operates and at all times observing the highest ethical standards. How did you do? If you had absolutely no idea how to solve this puzzle, you are not alone. The largely indistinguishable statements make the task almost impossible. Such vague, inflated mission statements may still be considered best practice in some quarters, but in many cases they do not achieve what they were intended to achieve, to inspire their employees with a clear sense of purpose. This section of the book is all about how to eliminate non-essentials in order to ensure that we can pour our energies into the activities that are most meaningful to us. The first type of non-essential you're going to learn how to eliminate is simply any activity that is misaligned with what you are intending to achieve. It sounds straightforward enough, but to be able to do that, you need to be really clear about what your purpose is in the first place, which is where this chapter comes in. From pretty clear to really clear. Executives I work with often suggest their company purpose or strategy is pretty clear, as if to say that is sufficient. But anyone who wears glasses knows there is a big difference between pretty clear and really clear. The same seems true with individuals' professional strategy. When I ask people, what do you really want out of your career over the next 5 years? I am still taken aback by how few people can answer the question. This would matter less if it were not for the fact that clarity of purpose so consistently predicts how people do their jobs. In working with executive teams, I have been amazed to see what happens when teams are only sort of clear about what they are trying to achieve rather than really clear. For one, there is a heavy price just in terms of human dynamics. The fact is, motivation and cooperation deteriorate when there is a lack of purpose. You can train leaders on communication and teamwork and conduct 360 feedback reports until you are blue in the face. But if a team does not have clarity of goals and roles, problems will fester and multiply. This is not just my theory or something I read in another business book. In gathering data from more than 500 people about their experience on more than 1,000 teams, I have found a consistent reality. When there is a serious lack of clarity about what the team stands for and what their goals and roles are, people experience confusion, stress, and frustration. When there is a high level of clarity, on the other hand, people thrive. When there is a lack of clarity, people waste time and energy on the trivial many. When they have sufficient levels of clarity, they are capable of greater breakthroughs and innovations, greater than people even realize they ought to have, in those areas that are truly vital. In my work, I have noticed two common patterns that typically emerge when teams lack clarity of purpose. Pattern 1, playing politics. In the first pattern, the team becomes overly focused on winning the attention of the manager. The problem is, when people don't know what the end game is, they are unclear about how to win. And as a result, they make up their own game and their own rules as they vie for the manager's favor. Instead of focusing their time and energies on making a high level of contribution, they put all their effort into games like attempting to look better than their peers, demonstrating their self-importance, and echoing their manager's every idea or sentiment. These kinds of activities are not only non-essential, but damaging and counterproductive. We do a similar thing in our personal lives as well. When we are unclear about our real purpose in life, in other words, when we don't have a clear sense of our goals, our aspirations, and our values, we make up our own social games. We waste our time and energies on trying to look good in comparison to other people. We overvalue non-essentials like a nicer car or house, or even intangibles like the number of our followers on Twitter, or the way we look in our Facebook photos. As a result, we neglect activities that are truly essential, like spending time with our loved ones, or nurturing our spirit, or taking care of our health. Pattern 2. It's all good, which is bad. In the second pattern, teams without purpose become leaderless. With no clear direction, people pursue the things that advance their own short-term interests, with little awareness of how their activities contribute to, or in some cases derail, the long-term mission of the team as a whole. Often these activities are well-intentioned, and some may even be essential on a personal level, but when people are working in teams, many disparate projects that are at odds with each other do not add up to the team's highest level of contribution. Teams like this seem to take 5 steps back for each step forward. In the same way, when individuals are involved in too many disparate activities, even good activities, they can fail to achieve their essential mission. One reason for this is that the activities don't work in concert, so they don't add up into a meaningful whole. For example, pursuing 5 different majors, each of them perfectly good, does not equal a degree. Likewise, 5 different jobs in 5 different industries do not add up to a forward-moving career. Without clarity and purpose, pursuing something because it is good is not good enough to make a high level of contribution. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The crime which bankrupts men and states is that of job work, declining from your main design to serve a turn here or there." When teams are really clear about their purpose, and their individual roles, on the other hand, it is amazing what happens to team dynamics. Formal momentum accelerates, adding up to a higher cumulative contribution of the team as a whole. So how do we achieve clarity of purpose in our teams and even our personal endeavors? One way is to decide on an essential intent. Essential intent. To understand what an essential intent is, we may be best served by first establishing what it is not. At the risk of using a consulting cliche, we can explore this using a 2x2 matrix. In the top left quadrant, we have vision and mission statements, like, we want to change the world. Statements that sound inspirational, but are so general, they are almost entirely ignored. In the bottom left quadrant, we have a set of vague general values, like innovation, leadership, and teamwork. But these are typically too bland and generic to inspire any passion. In the bottom right quadrant, we have shorter-term quarterly objectives we pay attention to, like increase profits 5% over last year's results. These shorter-term tactics may be concrete enough to get our attention, but they often lack inspiration. An essential intent, on the other hand, is both inspirational and concrete, both meaningful and measurable. Done right, an essential intent is one decision that settles 1,000 later decisions. It's like deciding you're going to become a doctor instead of a lawyer. One strategic choice eliminates a universe of other options and maps a course for the next 5, 10, or even 20 years of your life. Once the big decision is made, all subsequent decisions come into better focus. A non-essentialist has a vague general vision or mission statement. An essentialist has a strategy that is concrete and inspirational. A non-essentialist has concrete quarterly objectives, but ones that fail to energize or inspire people to take their efforts to the next level. An essentialist has an intent that is both meaningful and memorable. A non-essentialist has a value set, but no guiding principles for implementing them. An essentialist makes one decision that eliminates 1,000 later decisions. When Martha Lane Fox was asked by the British Prime Minister to be the United Kingdom's first digital champion, she had the opportunity to create a description for this newly created role. You can just imagine all the vague, uninspired, or jargony ways Martha might have tried to explain it. It was a Dilbert comic strip waiting to happen. Instead, Martha and her team came up with this essential intent: to get everyone in the UK online by the end of 2012. It was simple, concrete, inspiring, and easily measured. It gave everyone on the team clarity about exactly what they were trying to do, so they could coordinate their actions and energies to eliminate everything else. It empowered everyone on the team, however junior, to push back and say, "But does this new idea really help us to achieve our intent?" And it enabled them to